The show that's focused on investing strategies for today's needs and tomorrow's goals. This is Bucket Strategy Investing, presented by the Wealth Advisors at Lucia Capital Group. Now, here are Johnny Dean and Rick the Professor Plum.
Now, welcome to the program. It is Bucket Strategy Investing. Here we go again, back with more of the best in money information. As we said, Bucket Strategy Investing, that's the name of the program. Doing what we do best every day right here on your radio and your television devices. I'm Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum, back again with me for this hour's strategy session. And coming up for a segment or two, this hour we're going to be talking about your pension options. Yes, yes, pensions. They do still exist. And many people are coming up on the big decision here as to whether or not they should take a lump sum, if that's offered from their company, and be done with them, or do you take the annuity payments year to year? Now, I should tell you, this is not a decision that should be taken lightly, all right? And that's one of the reasons we're talking about it with Professor Rick Plum. We're going to tell you what your options are and how you can decide what might be best for you. In fact, we're going to give you some of the terminology, too. That's coming up because you do need to know that. If you got a question for the Brain Trust, and I'm sure you do, you give us a call right now, 877-PLANNER, P-L-A-N-N-E-R. That's 877-752-6637. Most of the lines are open right now at the top of the hour. To send us your emails, you go over to wealthed.com, our website, click on the Find Your Answer link. Professor Rick Plum, here again today, courtesy of the advisors at Lucia Capital Group. I want to remind you, you should know by now that you need a buckets plan, a strategy. You need one that's tailored specifically to meet your goals and your needs. So how do you do that? Easy. You call the professor or any of the advisors at Lucia Capital Group at this number, 800-644-1150. You can meet with an advisor, get your strategy set up, and get it going. Everyone's situation is different, and everyone's retirement plan is also different. So again, the number to reach them off the air, Lucia Capital Group, 800-644-1150. Our number on the air, 877-PLANNER. Lines open, as I said. Call now or anytime this hour. Ask your money question. We have the Brain Trust standing by to answer it. So pensions, we used to hear about pensions all the time. Go to work for a company, Professor Plum, you're there for 40 years, you get the gold watch. And you get the pension.
I heard those stories. I've never actually seen the gold watches.
Well, I never have either, although my grandfather did have one. I don't know whether it was from retirement or not, but they got together and gave him a watch. And, of course, he had a pension. Now, he was in a union and all that, and this was from having worked back in the 40s and the 50s and 60s and having retired way back then. As I look back, though, The pensions that people used to get, especially the factory worker pensions, mm-hmm. maybe not so much the executives, but they weren't all that much. And it quite frankly, even with inflation, wasn't enough to
live on?
Yeah, to live off of. So when we talk about the good old days of pensions, I'm not sure that they had it any better than a lot of workers do now.
And it's somewhat true depending upon where you're working, too. But a lot of pensions are driven off of income now, mm-hmm. where in the old days, and still some union pensions, are driven off of a dollar amount per year of service. Didn't matter what you made. I mean, you can make $10,000, you make $50,000. If you've got a year of service, you get X now, $85, $130, whatever, per year of service. Mm-hmm. So if you've got 10 years of service, it's $130, you get $1,300 pension. Didn't matter what you made over those years, it's a year of service, and yes. It's a flat dollar amount. But a lot of pensions, especially municipal and government employees, are a percentage of pay. So you get a specific percentage of your final average pay or your best
the last
average
three
pay,
years,
or however they want to calculate it, times the number of years of service. So if I've got my 10 years of service and it's a 2%, of pay at 60, whatever it is, it's the last year, the last two or three years that matter. I could have been making $10,000 a year for 8 years and then jumped up. And unfortunately, I've seen this being abused in some of the city workers that I've over the years, not lately, but where they had somebody been there for 30, 40 years and the last two or three years, because they base it on the last two or three years, they jump them up to like some kind of supervisor. And so, they're making the equivalent of $20,000, $30,000 a year for 30 years. And then for 3 years, they make like $80,000, $90,000, but their pension's based on $80,000, $90,000. Now that's a good pension.
Exactly. That's not bad at all. Well, we saw this. So let's talk for a second for the people who do have pensions. There's a choice some people have to make.
There's a choice anybody who's married has to make right up front, because anybody who's married is going to have to choose a form of payment that is either for the worker's lifetime, that is not the default setting, by the way, or providing something for their spouse. And so the default setting, based on federal law, is the default setting is the worker's life and then 50% of whatever the worker's getting to the surviving spouse. It doesn't matter whether the surviving spouse is 20 years older than them, in poor health or whatever, that's the default setting. And so while you're looking at your pension options, or when you're looking at your pension, looking at here's what my pension is expected to be, they're most likely showing you, you know, through your working years, what your pension can be for a single individual, life only. Now there's some terminology we need to go through. Life only is exactly as it sounds. The worker's life only. If the worker lives 120 years, they'll keep getting that pension.
Well, based on the claims paying ability, I don't know.
There's a PBGC behind them. On the other side, if the worker lives 2 weeks after making the irrevocable election, that pension stops when you have a life-only option. So a lot of people don't like that life-only option because while they don't think they're going to die very soon, you know, they never know in the back of their head. This is part of what they've worked for. This is part, and they don't want it to just go away that quick. Now, the other side of it is if you're married, as I mentioned earlier, you're going to have to make some election to provide something to your spouse, or you got to get your spouse to sign off that they're willing to give up any claim to the pension if you die too soon or before them. So unfortunately, that's very difficult to get the spouse to sign off on. But it can work. But the whole idea is, what option do you take? Now, to give the spouse a benefit, you obviously are going to take less in your own pension. So I work all these years and I'm expecting to get $1,000 a month. I'm just using a freezy math. But I'm married and I've got to provide at least a 50% option without, you know, her signing off on it to my wife. So instead of me getting $1,000, I may only get $900. And then if I die too soon, she'll get $450. But if she dies too soon, I'm still at my 900 number. So do I want to take that $100 haircut to make sure that my spouse has that $450 a month? And it works similar. Those aren't exact numbers, but it works similar to, regardless of the size. What's happening is they're going to look at the more that I offer the spouse, the less I'm going to get during my lifetime. And so there's these what they call joint and survivor options, where it'll pay out for the rest of my life and or my spouse's life, either at the same number, that's considered a 100% joint and survivor, or at a different number, and that's going to be a percentage, 50%, 75%, two-thirds, 66. And everything has a give and take. The more that I provide for my spouse, the less I will get during my lifetime, and a lot of people may or may not like that. But how do you go about choosing? Obviously, if we're just looking at the numbers, I want the highest number available, but that doesn't help my spouse if I die too soon. And that's always in the back of most people's minds, that you have to provide something for the spouse. So how much do you need to provide? That's just a planning idea. We look at what happens to the survivor if you're no longer in the picture. Now, if you've been diligent, you've saved up a bunch of money, or you have a lot of capital that can be applied towards creating an income, maybe you can take the life-only option. Or as long as, if that income and that $1,000 a month hypothetical that I used before, if that $1,000 a month goes away when you do, if your spouse still has enough income from other sources to survive and enjoy their retirement, fine, then take the life only. Now we have to look at what are the odds with your health that you live a long time or don't live a long time. Because if you're not healthy, even though your spouse may or may not need the money, it may still be the best use of the money. Take a little bit less now, provide more for your spouse later.
So you're saying it's sort of like Social Security. Your
health matters.
It's your longevity, your health, and the length of the benefit, in this case, the pension. So right. Even if you as the worker are not particularly healthy, it could be that your spouse could live well into his or her 90s.
Yeah, unfortunately, I've seen this with some people I know where the spouse was battling cancer at a very early age, late 50s. Mm-hmm. And the individual had a pension available to her. So when she retired due to health concerns, they took 100% in joint and survivor option. You know, I mean, they could have used a little bit of extra money, but they unfortunately knew that it wasn't going to last that long. And so her life, unfortunately, lasted, you know, 3 or 4 years. And then the pension is now paying out to the surviving spouse for a long time. Now enough money. They were getting ready to retire on their own at age 60. Mm-hmm. So they had probably enough money that if they hadn't taken that option, that he would have been fine. But because of the dynamics of what was happening, they took a joint and survivor 100% option because it made the most sense for the money that she'd accumulated in the pension. Now, she did not have a lump sum option because that is one of those options that can be brought into the mix. But so we have to look at what is happening with these numbers. What is there isn't a correct answer for everybody. Everybody should not just automatically look at it and say life only is for everybody. Life, you know, this and that thing. So you have to look at how it fits into your specific life. Now, there's a popular option, which is a life only for the owner, and then a term certain on top of that.
So that would alleviate the problem of the owner dying a month after he starts or she starts receiving.
Alleviates some of the problem.
But not all of it.
Maybe.
All right, well, we'll talk about this, some more of the terminology. Also, pension maximization, what is that? I know it sounds sort of wonky and, you know, difficult, but it's not. It's a way to make sure that perhaps you can take the bigger benefit option and have enough for your spouse using a technique called pension maximization. All right, 877-PLANNER. Hey, lines are open. If you have a money question on this or anything else, give us a call. Bucket Strategy. Welcome back. It is Bucket Strategy Investing. Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum, taking your phone calls, 877-PLANNER, P-L-A-N-N-E-R. We're going to get to more on this whole idea of beneficiaries for 401ks or pensions or whatever it is, lump sums, annuities, the terminology, what do we mean by term certain, all that stuff. And we talk about it because it's very important to you, especially if you have a pension. 877-PLANNER, our number. We'll take a couple of calls, 877-752-6637. We do have a line or two open, so grab it while you can. Let's move next to Kevin in Poway, California. Hi, Kevin.
Yeah. Hi, guys. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Beneficiaries for IRAs. Currently, they're set up spouse, secondary is the trust. I was thinking of changing it to spouse, son, tertiary, the trust. What is your opinion?
How many obviously spouse.
I got one beneficiary son.
And how do you feel about his ability to handle money? How old is he?
His ability is, he's today he would, he's coming along. His ability to manage is, I would say, on the poultry end of the track.
He's a work in progress, though.
Yeah.
So if, unfortunately, something happened to you and your wife, and he was going to inherit this money, who's the beneficiary, not the beneficiary, who's the trustee of the trust?
One of the family members, the trusted family member.
A trusted family member. So, because right now the reason for the trust is control, because you want somebody else besides your son to be in control of the money so he doesn't, you know, let's say call it what it is, he doesn't blow it, right?
Right.
And so that's more important than the ease of management going forward. The trust has more complexity to it. The trust, you know, the trustee has to continue to do his job or her job. The trust has to stay in existence. There's tax returns. There's things that have to go on that are more, a little more cumbersome than if he's named directly as the only contingent beneficiary.
Okay, let me go to the tax ramification. If it goes into the trust and then it gets, the administrator takes care of business, it seems like it's more of a tax.
It actually isn't an issue because the trust can be the beneficiary of the IRA, and the trust can still do a stretch of the distributions. Assuming okay. It was set up correctly, assuming the trust has the appropriate language, which most of them do, just check with whoever wrote it for you. The beneficiary is the trust. The trustee becomes the controller of the IRA, and we continue to do the required minimum distributions exactly as it would have been done otherwise. It's really easy when there's only one beneficiary of the current beneficiary of the trust. And so as the trustee would then pull the money, take the RMD every year. And then if the trustee at that point then passes the money to your son, the taxation will follow through to your son. So let's say that you've got a $500,000 IRA, the required minimum distribution is $16,000. I'm purely making that up.
Okay.
So the trustee, this is after you're gone, the trustee takes $16,000 out. If he then distributes during the same calendar year $16,000 to your son, the tax return that the trust files shows the 1099 coming in from the IRA, and then a distribution out to your son, there's no tax, assuming this is the only thing in the trust, there's no tax at the trust level. It's a flow-through entity. However, if for some reason your son is not doing what he's supposed to be doing, and in the trustee's discretion, he does not pay out the money because you've given the trustee that discretion, the money stays in the trust itself, but now in a personal account, that $16,000 taxable event is taxed to the trust. And so that is a much higher tax than it would be if it's thrown passed through to your kids or your son, but at least the money's still there instead of being blown out of proportion.
I understand. This was a good call. Let me summarize. The trustee will take care of business through an RMD.
Yes.
As long as the plan, the trust is being honored by the beneficiary, my son.
Right.
In the event that he stumbles, he still takes the $16,000, but the beneficiary gets nothing, and it's taxed at a higher rate.
Yes.
Next year, if things go well, we're back to the sunny side of the tax street.
Right, but now next year, so I'm the trustee. I've got $16,000 sitting in cash. I've got another required minimum distribution. Let's just say it's another $16,000. So now the trust has $32,000 sitting in the cash, and your son is doing everything that he's supposed to. He's giving up smoking. He's not doing this. He dumped that girl you didn't like, whatever the case may be. I as a trustee, depending on how you wrote the trust, I could give him all $32,000 and even pull more out of the IRA if I wanted, or if I've been given that control.
Okay. It sounds good. Now, question to you. Is there any beneficiary in a tertiary person primary, secondary, and tertiary in setting up an IRA?
Well, it's up to it. It would go based on, I mean, if you don't have, what happens if your son dies?
Right.
Well, it depends on if the trust is the beneficiary and you have beneficiaries listed after your son's passing, then it would be basically split up between them. And it has to come out at least as fast. Usually it comes out a lot faster than it was coming out when it was your son's beneficiary IRA or when your son was a beneficiary. On the other side, if no trust is named, it's going to go based on the rules of intestacy. And so it's based on the state. And then it becomes a little problematic.
A little more cumbersome that way.
So, you can set up, if you can get the company that's the IRA custodian to set up a second contingent or another layer of contingent beneficiaries, then naming the trust. And it's not that difficult. And to be honest, most people, you and your wife and your son don't die at the same time. And so but you can set it up for the trust. You can set it up for as many levels of beneficiaries as the company that your IRA custodian will allow.
All right. Listen, you really nailed it very clearly. I didn't even understand it. So my hat's off to you.
Well, thank you.
Have a good one, guys.
Take care.
Thank you, Kevin. Estate planning questions. We talked a little bit about that last week. Trust tax rates. If the money stays in the trust,
right,
even though it comes out, even though it's distributed, say, through an RMD or whatever in an IRA, and it stays in the trust, it's still taxed to the trust.
Right, whatever earnings the trust has. Now, we have most of the same tax brackets. We do not have the 10% bracket for a trust. But we still have the 15% bracket, the 25, 28, 33, and up the thing.
But
the problem is, a single individual doesn't hit the 39.6%, federal income tax bracket until they have well into the $400,000 of taxable income.
But for a trust?
About 12,000, maybe 13,000 of taxable income. And the trust is at that 39.6% bracket. The bracket percentage is the same. It's just the amount of money you can have in each bracket is really tiny. And you go from a 15 to 25, 28 really, really quickly. So the trust tax is a lot worse than an individual tax for the same dollar amounts.
And the reason, I guess, is because nobody wants to have all this money sitting in a trust.
Well, you're asking for the reasoning behind Congress setting rules.
Well, there's got to be a reason. I mean, obviously, there's no other reason to tax other than to try to force some sort of issue. In this case, is to get the money out of the trust.
Right, but that...
Who would leave it in the trust, pay a 40% tax when they could take it out and take it perhaps in a 10% tax bracket?
But there's but this one doesn't make sense. Normally I can make sense out of most tax law.
Yeah.
This one doesn't because leaving it in the trust and not letting somebody blow it means that they'll continue to get income for a lot longer period of time, even if it's the same thing. Because otherwise the person doesn't have any money, it's gone. No more tax anymore.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. I'll have to give that I'll have to mull that over during the break. Okay. A lot of complicated questions, but hey, listen, we got answers for you. Whether it's easy or hard, you give us a call, 877-PLANNER, PLANNER. Money questions asked
You have issues, we have answers right here on Bucket Strategy Investing. It is Bucket Strategy Investing. Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum answering your money questions here live on your TV and radio, internet and all that. We're also going to be answering it live in person. Yeah, that's right. Starting actually next month, but that's okay. You know, we're telling you about it early enough where you can write this down and actually sign up. The 2016 Retirement Income Strategies Workshops. These are back. You can register now at wealthed.com, put on by Lucia Capital Group. The next one is Saturday, February 20th. That's in Las Vegas. So if you're listening anywhere in Nevada, I don't care where it is, you come to Las Vegas Saturday, February 20th and meet the Brain Trust and get your money questions answered and strategies, too. Learn all about strategies. After that, Seattle, Washington, Saturday, February 27th, and then Phoenix, Arizona, a couple of weeks after that on March the 12th. Once again, they're all local time, 9 o'clock starts. They're all free, and you can sign up for all, any or all, at wealthed.com, W-E-A-L-T-H, wealthed.com, our website. Meet the Brain Trust, Professor Plum and Terry Keyes and everybody else. All right, back to the phone lines we go. We will talk more about these pensions, but we got to take some calls. 877-PLANNER, P-L-A-N-N-E-R. Let's move along to Victor in New London, Connecticut. Hello, Victor.
Hi, gentlemen. How are you?
Good. How are you today?
Good, thanks. Yeah, my question is a tax question, a step-up in basis question. I'm married, and what I did was I took a four-family house that I owned individually, and I gifted it to my wife for liability reasons.
Okay.
The four-family house was purchased by me for $60,000. It's worth, this is many, many years ago, it's now worth $350,000. My question is, if something were to happen to me, mm-hmm. is there a step-up in basis so my wife could sell that house at the $364,000 and not pay any capital gains tax?
Okay, basis changes under two circumstances. When you sell it for adequate consideration, if you go out and sell it, then it changes for the new person, but there's a tax at that point. Or when the owner of the asset dies. So in that situation, who owns it when you die?
When I die, technically, legally, my wife would own it.
And that means there's no step up in basis. Your wife
okay, so
is the owner.
Take it back, then.
Well, that's up to you, but your wife is the owner. And so the only time it's going to step up in basis is if she dies.
Hmm. Yeah, I was under the impression that you could gift between spouses, and there's no real problem with that as far as even step up was concerned. But I guess I'm incorrect.
Right.
So should I take the property back?
Well, that's up to you, depending upon whether or not the liability issue has gone away. So I can't answer that. But if you are looking at and you think that there's a high probability that you're the first one that's going to pass away, and you want to make sure that she inherits it, so you put rights of survivorship on it, put it in a trust, or put it in some way that can transfer automatically to her. If you want the step up in basis when you die, you have to own it.
Okay, so it's not a problem now that I owned it, give it to my wife, and now take ownership again. That I still will get she'll still get the step up in basis.
Well, yes, because whoever inherits it will get the step up in basis because you are the legal entitled owner. Now, when you were talking about gifts back and forth between a husband and wife, there is no issue from a gift tax standpoint, assuming both individuals are U.S. citizens. And so, Bill Gates could give his wife all of his stock or vice versa, and that's a few dollars of gifting. And there's no gift tax at the marital level. It's only when you get outside the marital level or outside of a U.S. citizen marital level that there's a potential issue for large gifts creating taxes. So back and forth, but it doesn't change the basis. The basis of the property is either the current basis going across or the current market value if that is lower than the current basis. And that's the only time, and so that's what the recipient receives as a basis because the value was much higher when you made the gift. The current basis flows across. She has a $60,000 basis. Now, people that bought houses back in 2005, 6, 7 through the highlight of the housing boom, they may have paid $350,000 for a house that is now worth $200,000. If they make the gift to somebody else, the basis is $200,000 going forward because it's lower than the original basis.
So the new basis on the person receiving it is either the current basis or, if lower, the current market value. So you cannot gift a loss, but you can gift a gain. Basis does not step up unless the owner dies or there's a sale.
Okay, so how do I get it back to sort of the step up for my wife? I have to take ownership of the property again.
You have to convince her to sign it over to you.
Yeah, well, no, that won't be a problem. I'll just offer something she can't refuse.
No, yeah, yeah, it's the same way, you know, a quit claim deed can transfer it back, especially if there's no loan or any liabilities on the property. So it can, just the same way you transferred it to her, you can transfer it back with her signatures.
Okay, and then I do have one more property in an LLC instead of in our own names individually. Now, we're both officers of the LLC. How does that work for step up in basis?
You're both members of the LLC, so you own 50% of it, she owns 50% of it.
Yes.
So the LLC is going to kind of be invisible in this respect. So the 50% of it that you own gets a step up. The 50% that she owns does not step up, because in our scenario here, you're the one that's passing away.
Right. Okay.
So look at who is the owner, and that's when the basis changes on a step up.
Great.
In the form of a 50-50 owner, you know, joint tenancy or tenants in common, you own 50, she owns 50, your 50 gets a step up, she didn't pass, her 50 does not get a step up.
All right. As usual, it's very informative talking to you guys.
Thank you, Victor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Victor. Appreciate the call. Good questions. In fact, we're going to be talking a little bit about gifting
tomorrow
on this program. So anyway, 877-PLANNER, PLANNER. Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum. Moving along to Tom in Seattle, Washington with a question. Hello, Tom.
Hi. I'd like to thank you. First, I called back to your question on savings bonds, and you referred me to TraceryDirect.com. And the amazing thing was it worked fairly easily and gave me the information I wanted.
TreasuryDirect.gov is what I hopefully said.
But I have one thing I haven't quite figured out. I inherited some savings bonds, and I'm trying to determine when the interest is paid.
The interest is paid.
If the bond is due in January or pays in January and July, if I redeem it in March, do I get the interest? And also, it just shows the month and year. So does it matter what day of the month I redeem them?
It shouldn't matter the day of the month, but it does matter. On the older bonds, it does matter when they pay interest. They only accrue interest semi-annually. So with an older bond, and older than more, I can't remember the exact cutoff, maybe 2004, 2005, any bond that was issued prior to that, they only earn the interest on their semi-annual anniversary date. So if it was a January bond, it earns interest in January and July. If you cash it in June, you don't get any of the last 5 months worth of interest. You get back to the last semi-annual anniversary date. So you want to, when you're timing selling some of these or cashing in some of these older bonds, you want to time it so that it's right after the anniversary, you know, and it should be the same month as they only go by month, so it shouldn't be an issue. If it's a July bond, cashing in July should not be an issue.
Okay, and then earliest in the month.
I missed that part.
I'm sorry, you're cutting out. What was that, Tom?
The as early in the month as possible, then, because if I wait until the end of the month, I just forfeit 30 days.
Yeah, you kind of are, I guess.
Yeah, but how much interest are they actually earning right now? You know, I mean, some of them are still earning 4%, which is on an annualized basis, which is okay. So, but they only pay interest on the older bonds. They don't do it monthly; they do it semi-annually. So, cash it in at the beginning of the month of the anniversary month.
5.2 to 3 something. So it's pretty decent by today's standards.
Yeah. Yeah, by today's standards, anything's decent.
Now, I also have 4 other bonds that are double E's dating back to 1992. Do the same rules apply?
The older bonds are the same way. Now, the first ones were I bonds?
Correct.
Okay, so those are, especially if they were purchased in the 2000 range, those are pretty nice bonds, and I may not want to cash those in for a while because they will earn interest for 30 years.
Yeah, right. I want to keep as many as possible. I have to distribute a couple of them to my relatives.
Oh, okay. Got to do what you got to do, right?
I'm going to take the lowest paying ones, but I'll do it on July 1st or 2nd would be the best way to go about it then.
Yeah, there's on the TreasuryDirect.gov, which is the government website. There is a savings bond calculator, and you can put it in, and it'll tell you what the current value is and what the current earnings rate is, and so you can get an idea of which ones you potentially want to cash in at that point.
Correct. That's what you told me last year, and it's worked out really well.
Well, at least I'm consistent.
Well, that's good. That's a good thing.
Okay. So, oh, one other thing. If I was to pass, the bonds are in my mother's name, and I'm also listed. If I was to pass away, who would the bonds go to? Would they just be part of my estate?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because I can't change anything now, right?
Well, were you the beneficiary of the bond, or were you a co-owner of the bond?
I think both, and some half and half.
Well, you should be able to add a beneficiary to it.
Oh, well, okay, so I can at least try then.
Yeah, try it. Worst they can do is say no.
Okay, great. Thank you, sir.
Okay, Tom, thank you for the questions. Wow, great questions so far this hour. Keep it up. We've set the bar high, and we've got another segment to go yet. If you need the brain trust, you want to talk to us, ask your money questions. We got a couple of lines open now. 877-PLANNER is our number, PLANNER, 877-752-6637. We'll still talk about some of this terminology with regard to pensions as well, but your phone calls and your emails do come first. Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum, it is Bucket Strategy Investing. Bucket Strategy Investing, Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum. I want to remind you, we do have other programs you can watch that include Professor Plum and me. What other reason would you need to watch? Every Tuesday, it is the Social Security Show coming up. It's at 1 o'clock Pacific and 4 o'clock Eastern time. It's only at wealthed.com. So if you're ever watching or you're wondering, gee, what should I do on Tuesdays at 1 o'clock Pacific, 4 o'clock Eastern time? Well, one of the best things you can do is to tune in at wealthed.com and watch the Social Security Show. We talk about your strategies for Social Security, talk about the different laws, the rules, and most importantly, we answer your Social Security questions. You send us the questions at wealthed.com. We answer them on the email. There's also a hotline to call. We'll give you that a little later on, and you can call and ask your question of the Social Security hotline. So, once again, Tuesdays, every Tuesday, the Social Security Show. Johnny Dean, Professor Plum, wealthed.com, 1 Pacific, 4 Eastern time. All right, our phone lines are open still. We're going to try to get to as many calls before the top of the hour. 877-PLANNER, PLANNER. Carmen, next up in Hollywood, Florida. Hi, Carmen. How can we help you today?
How are you?
Good. How are you today?
I have a sort of like situation, and it's sort of like tricky, and I was wondering if you could help me. It's involving my son. He's dead. Strategy is that I have all the legal documents over my son. He wasn't married, and his company closed down. There's a class action lawsuit. Do you think that's being tied if I have all the legal documents, the sort of guardianship over my son, giving me the power of everything? Do you think I'm going to be able to receive any benefits?
Well, I think you're going to have to look at what the lawsuit is. Your son was a part of a class action lawsuit against somebody. And so I'm assuming that if he has passed away, unfortunately that he's passed away, that any settlement should be payable to his estate or through his will. So, but this is a legal action. This is a legal issue. I don't know what the class action lawsuit says. I don't know whether or not it can survive past the individual who's actually named in the lawsuit. My guess is it should be able to, and you should be able to continue on in his stead. And so I would try it.
If I'm going to be able to be entitled.
I don't know the actual facts of the situation, but I would assume you can, but you'd have to ask the attorneys involved and what's going on.
Oh, I thought you had more like a secure response.
I would hope so. I mean, your son was in a class action lawsuit. He was one of the named plaintiffs going after somebody for some type of a settlement. Unfortunately, he's passed away. My guess is, and I am not a legal expert in by any means, my guess is that you should be able to step into his, if you were his heir, you should be able to step into his shoes and continue on with the lawsuit. I don't know for that for a fact, but that would be my opinion.
That's my assumption, too. And, yeah, Carmen, what I would do is, as Professor Plum just said, is check with there's an attorney or a group of attorneys that's handling this.
Or there's a lawsuit that has a bunch of very small print legalese. Look for what happens. It's probably spelled out in there. I'm sorry?
There's so many tricky things between attorneys, and you are the correct person that you come out live, and you sound very, I wanted to know, like, in your essence.
In my opinion, you should be able to do it, but I am by no means a legal expert in this in this area. And I'm not a legal expert in any area.
Yeah. So I tell you what, get in touch with the attorneys and see what they have to say about it, or the law firm that's part of this.
Sounds like she has a healthy distrust of attorneys.
Well, I mean, that may be true, but if you want to be part of some kind of class action lawsuit, or you know, one that your son was a part of, the only way you can actually become that is, I would assume, through contacting one of the attorneys or the law firm that's involved. So that's the best we can do for you, Carmen. I wish we could help you more than that, but not being actual, you know, lawyer types,
and not
having
knowing,
seen the facts of the case,
don't know what the settlement is, don't know what he's suing for, and I don't know what's going on.
I do know that these remember these class action lawsuits against the tobacco companies. Maybe they're still going on now. I don't know. But so many were filed on behalf of former smokers who passed away during the legislation. And I do know that at
it
least some
down.
Of those, it passed down to...
And that would be my assumption. It should be able to pass through. But I'm not going to say for legal certain.
No, of course not. No, this is not tax, legal, or investment advice. I think we tell you that every hour. Okay, let's move along. Email before the top of the hour. Ed in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I'm 81 years old, I'm taking required minimum distributions from my IRA, and I'm paying taxes on that money. I want to convert my IRA to a Roth and pay the taxes for the total required minimum distribution. Will they allow me to withdraw funds from the Roth the year after I do the conversion?
Well, let's make sure that you understand you cannot convert the required minimum distribution. The required minimum distribution has to come out of your IRA and stay out of the IRA world, traditional and Roth. So you cannot convert the required minimum distribution. But if you wanted to take excess money over and above the required minimum distribution and convert that, you're welcome to do so, and you just have to pay the taxes on it. Now the question of when can you withdraw the money? There are a couple different rules going on here. One is a penalty rule. You're 81. There's no penalty. And so your basis, whatever you've paid tax on in the IRA, can come out for any reason at any time because you've already paid the taxes on it and you're over 59 and a half. The earnings, whether or not you need to pay tax on the earnings, depends on when you started your first Roth IRA. If this is your first Roth IRA, then you have a 5-year time horizon before the earnings can come out tax-free. You're going to have to keep track of your basis and your earnings, and you're going to have to file a form 8606 in each year that you want to take a distribution for the first 5 years. Now, if you've already had a Roth IRA from some other conversion, from some other source, contribution, or whatever, for at least 5 tax years, now you're into what they call qualified distributions. Anything that comes out of the Roth IRA, regardless of how it got there, is a qualified distribution, which means it's tax-free. But it has to come, you have to have a Roth IRA in existence for at least 5 years to get to a qualified distribution, regardless of your age. So if this isn't the first one, and you started Roth IRAs previous to this, at least 5 years previous to this, you can take it out whenever you want. And it doesn't even matter whether it comes from earnings or principal or what. If this is your first Roth IRA, now we have to deal with the ordering rules. The money coming out first is considered coming from your principal, the money you've already paid tax on. But then if you withdraw all that and there's money left over, the only thing it could be are earnings. If you take those earnings out within 5 tax years of starting your initial Roth IRA, those earnings are taxable regardless of your age.
Are they penalized too?
He's 81 years old.
So
no penalty.
Doesn't
no
matter.
Penalties exist anymore.
Okay, well, that's good. That's good to know. All right, maybe we'll talk more about this because we did have a question on RMDs. If you need the brain trust off the air, you talk with Professor Plum or any of the advisors at Lucia Capital Group at their off-air number, 800-644-1150, 800-644-1150. For Professor Rick Plum, I'm Johnny Dean. It's Bucket Strategy Investing.
Information presented should not be considered specific tax, legal, or investment advice. You should always seek counsel of the appropriate advisor prior to making any investment decision. All investments are subject to risk, including the loss of principal. There is no guarantee that any investing or financial planning strategy will be profitable, provide protection from loss, or meet its stated objectives. Investment advisor representatives of Lucia Capital Group are also registered representatives of and offer securities through Lucia Securities LLC, a registered broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. John Dean is an associated person with Lucia Securities LLC. In the information presented, the opinions and views expressed are subject to change without notice and may not come to pass. Registration with the SEC does not imply a certain level of skill or training.